to the end of another day. Day well spent, being able to dedicate a day to contemplation of the Dharma, living blamelessly. It's very wholesome to be able to spend a day like this together, supporting each other. It's not for some of the people that we've begun to speak with, recognize for oneself that it's not necessarily that easy to undertake the retreat, but for many people, very fulfilling, something very important, some sense of rightness about the activity of contemplation and meditation and simplification. Sometimes the mind wonders, what are we doing this for, and what is this about, and it's pretty strange, doubting. However, even when that appears, however, there's still something that in spite of the doubts, in spite of that which tries to trip us up, that just continues. And some teachers say the process of awakening, you can go back to sleep, but you can't fully forget that one has had some kind of awakening, opening, which leads one into this kind of activity. So it feels very right, it feels very wholesome, but it also is challenging. There's something challenging about being with the momentum of our habits, as Kirisara was saying the other day, eyeball to eyeball with our karmic predicament, the feeling of our body and mind, the moods, the places we get distracted, all of this, to gather this into awareness, to bring attention to this, is not necessarily that comfortable. So it requires a lot of patience. This meditative work requires this willingness to start again, to be patient, and to be humble. Humble enough to be with the breath, rather than trying to figure out the whole universe and our place in it and how to solve all the problems, all of which is interesting enough. So there's something hard for us, that our minds, we want to live with the gods and to understand it all and to have the grand plan. And yet, so here we are learning to actually come to understanding through something very simple, very humble, very patient, listening to the body, listening to the mind, being with the breath, being with one breath. Jin Cha used to say, if you can understand the breath, you can understand everything. And in fact, one doesn't need to scour the cosmos for knowledge. If one can understand the nature of one breath, that the in-breath changes to the out-breath changes to the in-breath, there's always this rhythm, this change, and we can't, the breath isn't something we can control or own. We begin to get an insight into the nature of all things. All things have the same nature. They have their own rhythm, they change, and ultimately are beyond our ownership and our control. So as we begin to humbly and patiently receive one breath and notice the changing, we can also have moments of seeing where the breath, when it ends, when we breathe out, space, when we breathe in, there is that which is just present. We can have moments of noticing that even though there's change, the in-breath and the out-breath, there's change of the moods, feeling good in one sitting, feeling heavy and dull in another, change of the light from the morning to the evening, change from sitting to walking. We can, these very simple ways, observing change in a very simple way, very immediate way, we can begin to sometimes notice there's just the background, that which is just present, that which is just noticing the changes, which isn't changing, that which is noticing the changes, noticing the breath, that which is with the way things are, isn't changing. Everything else is moving, shifting. So this coming to be more rooted in presence, in awareness, in that which is just here. As soon as we try to think about that, what is that, then it's another thought that's changing and shifting again. As soon as we try and own, put a flag, the space of awareness, the space of presence, call it by a particular, this is a Christian space or a Jewish space or a Buddhist space, call it Buddha. Again, it's we're part of the changing world because of those are ultimately perceptions of the mind. So this meditative work, although very simple, coming to something very immediate, is also the breath can be a gateway. Something that opens a gate, opens us beyond the world of change. What tends to happen though when we start to sit, being eyeball to eyeball with our karma, we just feel often the momentum of our habits, the momentum of thinking, the momentum, the power of our moods, of our longings, of the stories that go around in the mind, of our memories, of our desire to become something that we're not. All of this the Buddha called floods, like floods. Floods that move us along in spite of ourselves. It's washed away to some mood that arises into some memory or longing or fear. Something that we feel we still need to get, something that we haven't got yet, that we need to become. So talking to someone today and making an analogy, when these patterns of the mind, when they're not, we don't have a conscious relationship to them, and they tend to just move us this way and that way, that it's a bit like in Africa where we live. We have these very, very powerful rainstorms. We have a day like this, hot, 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 and then it breaks in the afternoons into a massive storm. We keep waiting for the storm. And it's in the middle of the summer month, the rainy season, it's very powerful and a lot of rain, tremendous amount of rain. And it wears these gullies, call them dongas, in the hillsides. It erodes and wears down. Where there's a weakness in the soil, then the rain will flood down the gully and make a deeper and deeper groove. And in many ways we have these like dongas in our mind. We have these gullies. We have these patterns. The Buddhist word is sankhara. It means like a pattern, a habit. Some of them are very ancient, been there with us for a long time. Some of them are quite light, but mental energy, when there's no mindfulness, there's no gatheredness, there's no attention, it just goes down these old routes and wears away deeper and deeper into unconscious patterns of thinking and fantasy and desires about what we wish to do and become, longings, worries. For a lot of us it's just worry. We don't even quite know what we're worrying about, but we sit here for hours worrying, being anxious, or sometimes we worry about someone else, a loved one. I don't know if it does them much good. We can sit here and worry about someone that we're not with. It doesn't do us much good, so I don't know if it does the other person much good, but it's an unconscious habit. Something that we haven't really developed much, perhaps, clarity around. It's an old pattern, an old groove. So this patience, when we come across, when we start to bring attention into the moment with breath, this very simple method doesn't require great exertion, just very, very subtle sometimes movement to the present, then what becomes revealed sometimes are these grooves and patterns and tendencies that we have emotionally, physically, mentally, psychologically. So to be with these, particularly if they're uncomfortable or irritating to us, distracting, sometimes the mind just blurbling on and on and on and on and on and on about nothing in particular. So this patience of just being able to contain and to not to add more fuel, not to add more energy, to begin to contain and to allow some of these patterns through the mindfulness, through this attention, to lose their power over us. We just get to know them more. They don't disappear overnight, particularly if they're very ancient or deep patterns of fear. We all have ones that are very familiar to us. They don't tend to just go overnight, because we've put a lot of energy into them. We've invested a lot of sense of, this is who I am. I'm this kind of a person, and I think like this, and I have these kind of patterns and memories and identities. But little by little, as we don't add more, as we patient, then we learn to see some space, like between the in and the out breath, we see a gap, a moment when there's actually stillness between the movements. When we create space around these patterns, sometimes we can see, well, I'm not the pattern, I'm not the worry, not the thinking mind that's busy planning. It's just arisen, here it is, and it's got its own momentum, its own energy. And we can start to notice there's a spaciousness. So getting to know some of our patterns, getting to know the mind in its different aspects, the mind that judges. We all have this wonderful judge that sits and passes judgment on whether we're meditating enough or not, or whether we're good enough or not, and it, you can never be right with this judge. It will never let you be at peace. You can meditate here from 3 in the morning to 12 at night, and then you'll get up and something in the mind will go, that wasn't enough, you should have done a bit more. Mind will say, what are you doing just sitting here? You should be out working for the benefit of others, and working hard and doing service, and then you can go out there in the world and do all sorts of wonderful things, and the mind will go, well, you're just distracting yourself, you know, from the real job, which is enlightenment. So it can never, with this judging mind, it can never leave you at peace. Never mind others, I mean, it has a great time with others as well. We think of the people around us and the world around us. So we give that a lot of energy. We believe that kind of a mindset, and allow it to dictate to us, and shape our sense of self. It makes us feel inadequate, or wanting or lacking. Not enough, I'm not enough yet somehow. So these kind of, we're just beginning to maybe make a more conscious relationship, so we hear these voices, these tendencies, but we're not giving them the same kind of energy. We just notice, oh, here's the judge. Good morning, how are you this morning? What are you going to judge now? Well, that's interesting, that wasn't good enough, and that wasn't, and this wasn't, and that person over there, and so on and so on. But it's a very different relationship with these, the patterns might not go away immediately when we see them, but it's a different relationship to them when we do see them, because we can see them as what, for what they are. Sankara, pattern, an old tendency, condition from who knows where. And that which is knowing it isn't the pattern. It's just peacefully being here. So taking this, but this is patient work, to listen and to to allow the kind of space and the time to get this perspective and relationship, shift of relationship, particularly some of the subtle tendencies of the mind and the heart that are unconscious yet. So this calming practice begins to help illuminate the heart and mind, becoming present. When we become more present, we begin to see the subtleties, the layers of our conditioning, of who we think we are, how we perceive the world around us. So today, just also really looking at this effort, the effort needed, the kind of quality of effort. If it's a very strong, striving effort, then we tend to miss our ability of just being peacefully here. If it's too weak, then we just space out. So we've been looking at how to get a feeling for when effort is balanced, because mindfulness, samadhi, all of it is based on the quality of effort. It's all dependent upon what kind of quality of attention and application we bring to this moment. So the effort not to add to one of the mind is out of control. The effort to contain that which is uncomfortable and to be with it, and to listen and to the body when it's uncomfortable, to the emotions when they feel dislocated or sad, or to be patient with the mind that's restless and wanting something. All of this is a kind of an effort that's required. Sometimes the effort's very subtle. It's the effort to let go. It's a more effortless effort. It's an effort just to actually let go of will and volition. When the mind is very gathered, the mental energy is settled and calmed, maybe then the effort is just to just be present, to not have to do anything. So just getting a feeling for this range of how to make effort, how to make strong effort. The mind is in an unwholesome tendency and thinking that maybe the effort then is just saying, no, I don't need to go and dwell in that negativity. Or maybe when the effort's more subtle. So this calming practice that we've been cultivating the last few days, gathering, calming, stilling of thought, it's required that we've made some kind of effort to just be present, to use very simple methods, bringing the attention to the breath, to the body, sometimes to the whole body, the whole breath, sometimes to a very small part of the breath energy, the nose or at the belly. Until we get a feeling for what is it when the heart, the mind, the body is in balance. There's a sense of ease, a sense of relaxation. This approach to meditation is one that's very widely taught. It's the principle of bringing attention to an object, so-called object, whether it's a mantra or breath or body or sound, for the sake of calming, for the sake of becoming one-pointed. You'll find it in many, many different traditions, right across teachings of meditation. It's the same principle, whether it's a prayer, whether it's recitation, it's breath meditation. It's the principle of bringing attention and picking up an object and making the field of the one's attention more narrow than it usually is, until one begins to feel the mental energy calming. And so the Buddha taught that when this is well developed through a lifetime, and this is something we develop, this ability, this skill in calming meditation, it leads to certain fruits. some of which we've maybe experienced a little bit, or we've also talked about. It leads to a sense of well-being. It's not dependent upon how the world is around us or getting what we want. It can lead to a sense of inner fullness, inner well-being. It can lead to a sense of clarity. And peacefulness, and calm and peacefulness. And then when it's very well developed, it can lead to what's called the higher knowledges. The mind is very, very clear, very focused, very gathered, and there's more insight or understanding, subtlety of perceptivity, and one can understand or see what's unfolds, what's called the higher knowledges, the understanding of other people's minds, or the knowledge of past lives, future lives, and so on, all the things that fascinates us, psychic powers. But this really wasn't the goal of the Buddha's approach. It can happen, these more sensitivities can appear through this meditative. It doesn't tend to happen for many Westerners because our minds are so busy. You know, you get in the northeast of Thailand, you know, these rice farmers come sit, they'd be able to sit very still all night. You know, mind is not complicated, emotionally, psychologically not very complex. Minds able to enter samadhi very easily, have a sort of calm mind. But for most of us as Westerners, that's not our lot. We tend to have these very highly attuned intellects and enormous amount of psychological and emotional complexity, which, as Ajahn Chah used to say, we've got more rooms in our house. And so we have more spring cleaning to do, but when we spring clean, we have more space. We put different interesting things in space. So for many of us, this isn't the royal road to awakening, the road of just calming meditation, because we inevitably come across that which obstructs our ability to be deeply calm. So the Buddha, at the time of his awakening, in fact, all of the meditations that were taught were these Olympic feats. There were these yogis that he hung out with were like Olympic meditation masters, and they could get into these amazing states of calm jhanic refinement, where there is no sense of just very subtle consciousness, no perception in the mind, no sense of self or other, just very, very subtle planes of consciousness that they could access through these meditations. But what the Buddha noticed was that there was a limitation. There's a certain limitation in those kinds of meditations. And even when they bear the fruits, like for example his cousin Devadatta, who was one of these Olympic meditators in the story of the Buddha, he had all the psychic powers, was very impressive, was very into having a pure order, very powerful ascetic practices, wanted everyone to follow those, to be vegetarian. In a way, someone that was extremely impressive, but still in the heart wasn't purified, because at a certain point he became very jealous and tried to kill the Buddha. So something was not quite right in his meditation, obviously. Some view was still tainted by ignorance, by competitiveness. So in some ways it's quite fortunate, I think, that for many of us, that we don't reach these subtle levels of calm and then become attached to them, that we get knocked out of them very easily, something disturbs us, because then we have to begin to open to this other aspect called the vipassana, the contemplative, the reflective, the inquiry. So So Ajahn Chah would say, well, actually, ultimately, peace doesn't really come from just calm states of mind, but a truer or a more profound peace comes from wisdom, from really understanding the nature of the conditioned realm and its limitations, and to know directly that which transcends the conditions or the mortal or the patternings or the to know really the place where there is unchanging peace, not dependent upon a refined state of mind or not dependent upon states of calm. So this Vipassana, we'd like to begin to explore this, because when we leave this retreat space and we enter our daily life, we can't depend on a kind of environment that supports a lot of calm. We all know that. This calming meditation is also, in a way, to a certain degree, dependent upon us having, all of us, been quiet, having this kind of an environment. It's also dependent upon a certain use of will to sustain the kind of effort that's needed to hold the attention in a certain way. So sometimes you have people experience having a lot of calm in a controlled environment, and then when they can't control the environment, there's a lot of sensory contact, or they get ill, and the will, when one's ill and sick, one doesn't have such a strong will, or one's overwhelmed, then one feels like samadhi, the peace, the calm's just gone, just out the window, and the old habits of reactivity become very powerful. So as nice as it is just to get calmer and calmer and calmer, we need to also cultivate and balance that with this inquiry, this Vipassana, to look more carefully what obstructs our ability to be peaceful. Because ultimately, as Kirisara was saying, this teaching of the Buddha, vimutti, which means the heart's always free, the heart's always peaceful, vimutti, sara sabbe dhamma, the essence of all things, the essence of the heart itself is already free, it's already peaceful. In this moment, there's no way we can make the heart more peaceful, but it's something that obstructs our ability to directly know that we have to engage with and to get perhaps consciousness around and a different relationship with. So whereas samatha or calming meditation leads to peace and tranquility, centeredness, gatheredness, vipassana or insight meditation leads to wisdom and freedom, and they're not divorced from one another. They work together, they balance each other. So the next part of the retreat, we'd like to bring some of the calm based upon this work with the breath, the body, centering, bringing attention in a way that can inform our inquiry as to what obstructs us in our ability to be peaceful here and now, in a way that's not dependent upon the mind being a certain way, because we can't always control that, or dependent upon the environment being a certain way, or the body being a certain way, because we can't control those things ultimately. So we're always vulnerable to being swept away, to being overwhelmed. The first two things that obstruct our ability to be rooted in presence, rooted in awareness, rooted in our fundamental nature of peacefulness is this disease of the mind. It's like a disease when it's not conscious, or sometimes it's called a fever, like a fever of wanting and not wanting. The mind, there's always something we want and there's something that's here that we don't want. And we're always caught between these two powerful movements. Sometimes the word in Pali means thirst. Tanha is that the craving, something that we're craving, and something that we're averse to, we don't want. So when we're not conscious about these two primary movements of the mind, then they're constantly hijacking us, constantly pushing us in a certain direction. It's not that these energies are bad in and of themselves, but it's the unconscious relationship to them that makes them, spins us out of our centeredness. So this wanting, when we sit here, we can feel the mind is seeking for something, wanting something that's not here. It's not enough. And this is Ajahn Chah says, like a dog with mange. He made an analogy. He said, you know, it's like a dog. We're like a dog and we're itching. We have a disease and we're itching, and so we run to one place to try and get some relief. And then it doesn't work, so we run somewhere else. Try and get some relief and run somewhere else, and it goes on and on and on like that until the dog realizes actually it's not the place that's the problem, it's the fact there's a disease. So this is how, when there's an unconscious relationship to these two energies, this is how we experience ourselves, like some kind of itching, disease or fever. So this wanting, we can begin to contemplate, and the Vipassana, we begin to notice what is that energy like that's always looking somewhere else. It's always, if you notice the energy of desire or wanting, is always pointing to somewhere over there. It's never saying it's enough here and now. It's always better, it's always going to be better when whatever. You know, when I'm peaceful, when I'm enlightened, when my family troubles are well, when we've sorted the political problems, when we've got the ecology right, then all of those things are important. It's not to say that they're not important. Work at those things. But when we're just driven by this idea that somehow, sometime in the future, it's all going to be right, it's all going to be finished, it's all going to be perfect, then we're like that we're never able to settle. So this feeling of being driven. So it's not that we can't use that energy, but to make it more conscious, and just in the Vipassana, beginning to notice when it arises in the mind, I want to be more peaceful now. And we can just note, what does it feel like? Where does it emerge in the body? What is the shape of it? How does it shape the sense of self, the sense of me and where I'm going? Can we explore it? Can we notice it for what it is? Can we not move with it? So can we see that energy move, like the breath moving in and out, desire manifesting and moving? But can we know that which is just seeing it, that which isn't moving, and becoming the desire, becoming the wanting? So when that's not in the mind, then sometimes we have the other aversion, not wanting. Averse to the heat, or averse to a painful body, or we don't even know sometimes what we're averse to. Some resistance, we just don't want to be here, don't want to wake up in the morning, alarm goes off, and we can sometimes get in touch with that feeling very strongly, first impulse. I don't know many people that leap out with a great shout of joy when the alarm goes off first thing in the morning. Whoopi, it's great to be alive, good to be here. Often there, what meets us is this very deep and powerful sense of, it's called vipuetana, not aversion, just not really, it's resistance. Meeting life with this feeling of something tight, resisting, averse. Meeting our experience of our body, when we come to touch into our body, our mind, our feelings. It's resistance towards others. Sometimes we can have quite a lot of ill will. The sense of willingness is ill, not full, not warm. So this is, we all suffer from this. It's not like only one person in the room has that experience, but rather than be ashamed of that or try and repress that or try and quickly push it away, we can actually just become conscious. This is ill will. This is aversion. This is wanting. This is not wanting. I don't want this and I want that. And often they actually work together. We don't want what's here, but we want what's over there. So in our inquiry, in our contemplation, we can just begin to notice, that's all. Very simply, just notice when those appear in the mind, in the heart, in the body. In the same way that we bring our attention to the breath as a method to calm, to stabilize, to gather, we can bring that same quality of attention to investigate. What is the nature of craving, of desire, of looking, of seeking? What does it feel like? How does it shape the sense of me becoming? Because if we're not conscious of that, we become our desires. We just become that movement without any consciousness. Maybe that's what we want to, but if there's consciousness, it can be guided. Okay, we have to use that energy. And we become our aversions. We get shaped by those energies. So just beginning to notice. So these first two, what's classically called that which hinders our ability to be here peacefully, these two energies. Beginning to notice them, noticing the other hindrances, the dullness of the mind, heaviness, and then its opposite, the restlessness, can't settle anywhere, bouncing around. Last one, going through these briefly now, these five classical hindrances, the last one's called doubt, which is an interesting one because it's very subtle. It's quite a subtle one to see, and it trips us up a lot. We want to say something very simple, use the technique of being with breath, the mind starts to doubt. Well, is this going to be helpful or not? Or maybe I should do something else? Or maybe I should not be on the retreat? Or maybe the mind just constantly undermines something that we want to do. It's just that energy that undermines. I'm trying to figure something out. It's doubting energy. So just seeing that, when we can see that, what should I do in my life? Should I do this or should I do that? What should we do about a relationship or our work? That which can see doubt, it isn't doubt, it's confident. It can be, it can see doubt, but it's not fooled by it, it's not driven by it, it's not tripped up by it. So this is the mind doubting, in fact, I don't know. Can we be with, I don't know. Actually, can we allow the space for in the mind when it doesn't know, doesn't have to have an answer? We just can know this is doubt. I don't know if this is the right thing to do or that's the right thing to do. I don't know if, but maybe I can make a space and then perhaps from a different kind of place a knowing can emerge. So these that hinder our ability to be peaceful. These are patterns, aspects of the mind that we can get to know. The Buddha said once we actually have a fully conscious relationship with these hindrances and are no longer driven by them, no longer overwhelmed by them, no longer fooled by them, it's as if one is freed from prison, or freed from slavery, or freed from debt, or another analogy he gives, which I like very much, is as if you've been in a desolate country and you find your way out of it, find a home territory. So encourage us to, in this meditation, this contemplation, to not just limit it to sitting in this formal posture, not to just limit it to when the mind is calm, but to be able to have some adaptability, flexibility to inquire when we're walking, when we're eating, when we're talking, to just be able to reflect what is hindering, what is happening, where is there wanting, where is there not wanting, is there peacefulness here. This kind of more reflective type of meditation is one that one can transport into our everyday activity and is not so dependent upon having a specialized situation. So we can leave it there for this evening.